Welcome back to Dice and Salt. I'm Lady Toast.
And I'm Lord Richter.
This week we have episode 163, The Presence of a Gnome. I don't really know if this is a reference to something or if it's just...
It feels like it is. I mean, I read it and I think...
It's got to be a reference to something. But I'm not sure what it is.
I didn't catch it. I missed it. Yeah. Whatever it was.
However, this is the first fully 3D printed podcast.
It is.
It's very nice.
And everyone was buying a lot of filament, I heard.
Yeah. Just remember to dry your filament. It makes printing easier.
That's right.
And to make... I have a friend who decided they were going to put their printer on... They have a piece of half-inch foam board. And then they have a literal slab of granite that they got from somewhere. And they have their printer on top of that. And they're like, oh yeah, this is the most stable thing I've had in a while.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That sounds nice.
Yeah. It's not a very thick piece of granite. They put a picture and it's a quarter of an inch thick. But it's heavy, right? And the foam underneath keeps any wobbles out, I guess. I don't know.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know how it works. I was just told that it printed better that way.
Oh, I'm sure it does. I mean, I would think it would kill a lot of the energy, motion energy that the printer would put out as it's printing.
Right.
Because that's what you paid for, folks. The half-assed approach to 3D printing that you have here on Dice and Salt. It's my left cheek and Toast's left cheek. That's what you got.
It was 3D printed. He didn't say what it was printed out of. It could be resin printed.
It could be resin printed. That's true.
Could be really,
but they
nice
said
podcast.
Filament, so you know, whatever.
That's fair enough. Welcome to the PLA podcast. Well, so
is that the People's Front of Palestine or Palestine's People's Front?
What?
Sorry, you said PLA, and I thought of the People's Liberation Army, which then got me thinking because of current events that the P could also stand for something else, and of course I thought then of Palestine. The reason for this is current events in Israel, and I've seen Monty Python's Life of Brian.
Always look on the bright side.
Right, the very end. There's a scene where they're in the local Colosseum, and they're sitting there, and they're talking about the People's Liberation Front of Palestine, the Palestine's People's Liberation Front, and all these various combinations of these things. Mm-hmm. And that's, of course, the joke. But anyway, that's what popped into my head.
Okay. I don't actually know what PLA stands for. I just know it's a type of filament.
I'm sure that it is.
Yes.
I believe that China still calls their army the People's Liberation Army, the PLA.
Okay. Well, I was talking about plastic, but...
That's fine. It's absolutely fine. It's just RPG stands for role-playing game or rocket-propelled grenade if you grew up in the 80s.
Oh.
Well, it stands for RPG from the 80s, too, but, rocket-propelled grenade as well.
I was trying to come up with a funny definition for it, but my brain is not functioning, which is fine. So we start this one off with a surprise round.
We do, in Kyodera Forest.
Yeah, a brand-new forest, which... Given how they end the episode, right, it almost sounds like this forest is like a ring, right? Because it would be the outer edges of the explosion, and then the inner edge is where the negative energy was from the radiant fire. So it almost makes it sound like it's like a circle, but it only occupies the outer width of it.
Like 10 miles? A 10-mile radius circle?
Right, and so
didn't
it
they
would
get
be
dropped
like,
off 10 miles from... Two or three episodes back?
I don't know. Because, I guess so.
It was like a 10-mile walk. But, yes. Everything in the description of the Radiant Fire is we're not dealing with a wave motion gun, which fires the big beam of particle energy and smaller beams swirling around it. No, this is, a nuclear blast. It just kind of goes and then, in a big... half-circle, dome, if you will, a dome, half-sphere.
So it just made me think of a giant target symbol, if you were looking at it from above with the castle in the middle, and then you have the barren wasteland, and then you've got that waving forest.
Yeah, I think that's an accurate way of looking at it based on the way it's described, 100%. In fact, I think it's the only conclusion you can arrive at based on what we've seen from prior descriptions, specifically at Renchurch.
Right.
We don't get any other description how it goes off prior to that.
Right.
I don't think. We sort of get, you know, we just kind of, it's radiant fire and something happens. We don't actually ever see until Renchurch, and then we see how it's, you know, blasting
just
out.
Just a blinding white light, moving towards them very rapidly.
Right. But as like a wave. I mean, it was described as like a wave or a wall as it came out.
Yeah. But, yeah. So,
I think you're right on. I would say, though, with your description and with the AP, we get a new radiant fire effect this time. Because in...
it's like they...
They didn't coordinate.
Well, as for like the different effects, I mean, I think we've kind of discussed it before where like the different areas might affect what actually happens afterwards. But like it might also depend on the type of magic that Tarbephon pours into the shards, right? Because like you've got different, because it never just tells like what spell he's using. He could just be putting in like raw magic power.
Well, I don't think he is using a spell. I think he's manipulating. He's finding a way to create a feedback in the positive energy, and he's using negative energy to do that with the reflective, because that's what he has. He's, you know, a ball of negative energy. So that's why it's, mixed with the two.
Maybe it's the actual shards that are exploding on, you know, the far end, you know, their specific shape or whatever. I don't know.
I don't know.
I don't know.
I think it simply boils down to they created something, and when they first started the AP, they just needed to give it a name and didn't need to describe it. And then as they got towards the end of the AP, suddenly, well, this is how it works.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, wait a minute, then how come these other descriptions in book two, and in, you know, book three, when Vigil goes, and then in book four at Gallowspire, we don't see the same thing.
Right.
So you know, it's kind of... Anyway.
Anyway, we're fighting an ooze.
Enough of this non-Euclidean radiant fire.
Yeah.
Sorry. That'll come in, folks. I promise.
Yeah. But they're fighting this ooze. I always liked oozes. They're fun to run against players. I find them fun.
Oozes are a lot of fun. And violent. And violent. Yeah.
Usually they're pretty mindless, and they go for kind of, you know, whoever's nearest. But this one isn't, actually. So it's actually kind of a nice change. It's actually a sentient ooze. I don't think there's a whole lot of those in Pathfinder.
Yeah, they've got tons. They've got, I know there's several that are Cthulhu-specific.
Right.
So they're inspired by... Strange Aeons has them.
Yeah.
And... you know, and then of course there's the classic oozes like, you know, green slime, black pudding, gelatinous cube, you know, kind of the desserts, the dessert oozes, if you will.
Yeah. I liked running the gelatinous cube because the last time I ran them, it was in a literal maze and they would slide out of a hidden, you know, a hidden wall would slide around and they'd be literally just as wide as the door or the corridor. So that you couldn't escape them by going around them. you had to run back.
Nice.
But the best part about that was there was two of them, and they tried to trap you between them.
Oh, God.
That was fun. I enjoyed doing that.
That's awesome. So you were a big D&D movie fan when the gelatinous cube rolled into the maze brawl at the beginning.
I did like that. It was fun. But
it's very, very strange shape, that cube.
Yeah. I see in our notes that you have a rant that you would like to go on here about Alex's description of this creature.
Well, Alex calls it he describes the creature as non-Euclidean.
Uh-huh.
And I had to do a little digging because our world, in the way we look at our world, the way we describe the surface of the Earth for purposes of geographic information systems, you know, GPS satellites, all this kind of stuff, the orbits of the planets in the solar system are all using non-Euclidean geometry and mathematics.
Right, because they're not perfectly circled.
Right, And you can't describe them by some combination of circles.
Yeah. I mean,
so it was believed. The famous one that made that impossible and thus the search for the non-Euclidean way is the retrograde motion of Mars, where Mars is tracking through our night sky and then suddenly leaps backwards.
Right.
So,
but that has to account for, you know, when they were thinking that the Earth would go around the sun and everything was going around.
Well, even when they switched to the heliocentric.
Even afterwards? Okay.
Even afterwards, they still saw them in circles because that's how they did the geometry.
Yeah, which is why they couldn't figure out Mercury's orbit for a long time. Like, they knew the orbit, but they couldn't prove it, and it took relativity to prove that, which I thought was really neat.
They've had some interesting things where they were unable to do it with circles. Or at least the effort that they put into it, they went, we can't seem to go far enough. And when they eventually did solve it for the retrograde motion of Mars, it was a very complex circles within circles within circles to make it all work. And very complex math. And it took a computer to grind it far enough to make it happen.
Right.
But that did prove that you could calculate these things in either the Euclidean way or the non-Euclidean way. We are already in the non-Euclidean, so we stuck with it. But the point of saying something is non-Euclidean nowadays, doesn't carry the same kind of weight that it did when that phrase was more prevalently used. Now, I looked into, and I thought Alex was confusing some other words with his use of non-Euclidean. I was thinking of like antediluvian or cyclopean, specifically from H.P. Lovecraft.
Mm. And here I thought I know
he used those terms and wrote horror. So I thought, hey, you know, this has got to be where he's going, right? Mm-hmm. Probably over zeroed in, whatever. And sorted out that it appears that when Lovecraft said things were non-Euclidean, he was meaning that they had curves or shapes that were very strange and couldn't be created in the Euclidean geometry space, things that you could see every day potentially. I'm sorry, maybe not every day, but you could see it. You could maybe imagine it, but now you're having a whole bunch of it. I did read
for Lovecraft. When I think of like when he describes like non-Euclidean things, my go-to for that is things beyond your brain's ability to comprehend. Right. Like, that's kind of his version of madness,
right?
Where you just can't comprehend it. Or, I guess his version of madness is you get just the briefest of glimpses of to what it actually is, and then you can't perceive it anymore, and you kind of go mad trying to reconcile the two. I think that's how his madness works.
Yeah, he had, specifically when he talks about Riley, which was the example I was focused in on, in the Call of Cthulhu story, one of the guys who's walking on the island says that the buildings, his perception of the building, his perspective of looking at the building changed when his perspective changed. So as he looked at it, walking up to it was one way. And then when he walked past it and looked back, it looked totally different, or it, you know, changed shape. And in one of the things I dug up, they were saying that if you understood the Euclidean geometry, that what would happen is, let's say I have a flashlight and I turn on a flashlight in a Euclidean sphere, the light would curve all the way around and come back and illuminate you from behind. So your flashlight would have that kind of effect. And if it was non-Euclidean, then things could get wild. So
maybe he meant like M.C. Escher-esque, where it's all over the place.
Yeah, no. I think he did. I think that it, you know, it's a term that at the time it was used was probably pretty understood, you know, kind of what you were trying to say. And it has less meaning for us now because everything we calculate is non-Euclidean.
Right.
And I did find a definition, and Alex did mention to me, because I sent him a thing saying, what the heck are you saying, dude? Everything in our world right now is non-Euclidean, so it's normal. You know, it's a normal ooze. He said that non-Euclidean can be used to describe something that's shaped weird, usually of a shape that can't be easily described.
I mean, I can see that.
You know, like
like an older usage or something.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. Like a...
So perfect for someone past their prime, like Alex.
And on that note, we've talked about Euclidean and non-Euclidean.
Yeah.
Anyway, so that's what I wanted to go off a little bit on.
No, it's fine.
Because, you know, fun and excitement and, you know.
Oh, yeah.
I'm way past my prime because I still remember hanging out with Euclid and shooting some of those baskets, baby.
I guess once the actual battle starts, it kind of attacks Uhtred and really does a weird thing. It turns his, like, shoulder to wood.
Yeah, it hits him with the deck strain.
Yeah, which was massive.
It's a deck strain.
Yeah,
with the sucks giant six. Wood.
But then, like, Valbar comes along and almost trivializes the whole fight.
he doesn't almost trivialize it. He absolutely trivialized it. This was the Valbar we've been waiting for. This is the hey, I am dominant. Let me show you what I can do moment.
Right.
And it was overwhelming presence.
Yep. And I am, like the guys in the episode, very surprised that attacks don't give it another roll to get out of it.
Yeah.
That's
bonkers. But I looked at it and it that was my read.
Yeah. Because I looked it up myself and I'm just like, it really doesn't say that anywhere. Like, and other things will say that, you know, if it takes damage or if it's attacked or whatever, it gets a new save. It's just not there. Like,
you know what? I didn't double check. What I'll double check right now really quickly.
Okay.
I believe it may require concentration. And if that's the case, it takes the caster out too. So that might be why.
Mm.
But I'll check real quick and make sure that's accurate.
Okay. Oh.
No, there's duration is just one round per level.
Hmm. Okay, then. It's just an overwhelmingly powerful spell.
Yeah, and it's got a haste targeting. So it can be multiple creatures, and no two of which can be more than 30 feet apart. Wait. Each round on its turn, a target of this spell may attempt a new saving throw to end the effect.
Mm-hmm.
This is a full round action that does not provoke attacks of opportunity. So it could have recovered. It could attempt a new save each round.
It did recover.
No, it didn't. It died.
No, because they didn't defeat it while it was still basically worshiping Valbar, because it did get free, but it didn't get... I'm pretty sure it got free, but then they pretty much killed it right away with, like, the lightning balls and stuff.
Well, I don't remember it making it save, but either way, it went down, so...
Well... Yeah, because it backs off and says something to Valbar that only he hears, and he goes, that's the plan, or that's the idea.
Oh, yeah, he goes, you better kill me before the effect ends,
Yes. Is that what they said? Oh, see, I heard that as it had gotten free.
No. It didn't back off, it just said it to Valbar, and Valbar says out loud, that is the plan.
Yeah.
I did that accent wrong, folks. It doesn't sound like our happy gnome at all.
Yeah.
He would have been way more cheerful.
Okay, well, that makes a little more sense then. Because I thought he'd gotten free and gotten one turn, but I guess not.
No.
Oh, I misheard that entirely. All right, well.
Well, I can get why, you know, because it was responding, you know.
It was responding in a way like it had broken free of its control. Or from the spell.
Right. It was, yeah. Which makes for better, I think, entertainment.
Right.
Than to just be like, I'm so correct. Overcome, you're the divinity.
So I guess that's why I thought it was free.
Because it would, it says that a creature recovers early after being affected for at least one round, takes 1d6 points of wisdom drain, and is staggered for 1d4 rounds. And that sucker never even had that.
Yeah.
They never even did any of those calculations that I recall.
The only other thing I could think of that might have been it getting free is like it takes the full round action to do it. So maybe it got free but couldn't move or do anything else.
That's possible. I'll be honest. I don't remember hearing that, but that is entirely possible.
Yeah, I don't remember. You know, like I said, I in my listening, I thought it had gotten free, but I guess it just really didn't. So
we'll just have to let chat straighten us out, because I got to it got dropped and I was like, okay, well, that was done.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I bet that combat didn't go the way Alex wanted.
No, but those are fun though sometimes. That's true. Wow,
Yeah, it was nice too because Valbard had been knocked out of a couple combats, basically been like, I can't do anything other than buff.
Right.
And we even, you know, we even, I think, had a brief conversation about how we were waiting to see what he could really do. Valbard could really do, right?
And right.
Like, we're like, yeah, he got knocked out of a combat. So I don't know, you know. But, and here it is. This is what he can do.
It's good. Like when he's up against creatures that he can affect, like it's.
Oh, yeah. It's shutdown time.
Extremely effective. He may not be and able to put out a lot of damage, but
yeah,
he's very good. But I mean, at
you know, just battle, sorry, you're done. Control. Yeah, you're on the ground, prostrating yourself, taking a beating.
Yep,
that's right. You'll take it.
Yep. I guess after they defeat this thing, another tree in the area basically, I guess, dissolves into the dead body of the paladin.
Yes. Yes, but remember the blight's ability to do the dex drain. As it drains you, it turns you into
wood.
Into a plant.
Yeah.
There's another... In Skull and Shackles, there is a trident that the Sahagin chieftain has that has that power. It dex drains you, and it you know, the descriptor for it is that it slowly turns you to stone. It petrifies your body slowly as it drains the dex.
Oh, okay. Well, I mean, I can see that.
Makes right. sense. So I was like, oh, hey, they're using that again, except this time it's not stone, it's wood. And then I'm going to assume that Alex took that and made that the tree. And when it's gone, then the tree becomes the dead body.
Yep.
Instead of that being in the AP. I don't know. Book six retrospective.
Yeah.
Question right here. And then we go into a haunt.
Well, they interrogate him first, right?
Oh, I'm sorry. They interrogated the scout.
It turns out he doesn't really know things because he's not really good at anything other than smack the thing with a sword.
Right. He's a paladin.
Right.
He's, let's see. He's you know, like Thalias.
Like Thalias used to be.
No, he's like Thalias, the champion in Thalias. And that's, you know, he's still essentially a paladin.
Ah, okay. I've never actually played a paladin. I don't know how they work mechanically other than they hit things real hard.
they absolutely can hit things really hard.
But the stereotype is like they're not dumb. Like they may not be like the skill monkey.
Yeah,
hunter, but
they just cast them as, you know, one dimensional.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I guess that's fair. They're usually
and
the butt end
of
a joke.
Uptight, stuck up, one dimensional. Yeah.
Okay.
And I was thinking of it more as, you know, Thalias playing a paladin, and he's, you know, womping on things and. You know, he's got, you know, what the hell did I call that thing? Shovelnir. Yeah, now I got to go look back at my things and you know, trowel or not trowel. Yeah. What did I? God damn it. Now I got to go look back and see what those are. But, you know, I was thinking of that and thinking about how basically it's the same kind of thing. You know, he's got the same kind of guy. I go in and I smacks it. Mm. And, you know, why would I ever use the Hierophant? Because I got to smacks it. You know.
Yeah. But yeah, they do actually end up finding their way out of the forest, and like we said, out of the ring and into the, I guess, inner ring of nothing but like ash.
Right. Right. And the haunt starts.
Yeah, so they start flying over the surface because they're like, we're not walking over this. Absolutely not.
Well, I believe that it catches them right as they're I believe the way this episode ends. Is right. They get to see it, and then bam, next week we'll, and the haunt triggers, and next week we'll roll for our will saves.
Right. It'll get their surprise round, and.
Yep, yep.
Haunts are always so weird mechanically.
Yeah, they have something. I think that's why they call them traps, or count them as traps or something. There's some.
Yeah.
There's something. Like, just... No, I want to say, was it not tricks? There's traps, and then there's some obstacles or something.
Hazards?
Hazards. There you go. There you go. I know we've had this conversation before.
Yeah, we have. We definitely have. But yeah, I guess if they're going to deal with the haunt, that's next week. And I guess that's gonna do it for us this week. You can find the pinned comment that I'm not reading in our DMs. Yeah, that's going to do it for us this week. You can find us and the players on the Inspired Incompetence Discord. Links can be found at inspiredincompetence.com. I'm Lady Toast.
And I'm Lord Richter.
We'll see you next week. Bye.
Bye. Next up, the sultry tones of Toast with a terrible taste in her mouth.